Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. The Industrial Revolution fundamentally changed the way we work and live our lives. And according to my next guest, we are now in the midst of another major upheaval. Of course, you know that. If a phone alarm woke you up this morning, if you got oriented to how the world changed overnight by scanning through Twitter, or if you're streaming this radio conversation right now from a continent away. Like it or not, the digital age is here, and much like what the steam engine did in the 18th century, there's a transformation in every aspect of our lives and work. But what really do these rapid changes mean, and where are they leading us? Eric Brynjolfsson, along with Andrew McAfee, offers his take in a new book. It's called The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. Eric is also a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management and the director of the MIT Center for Digital Business. Hi, Eric. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Anna. It's great to be with you.
So as you write, the second machine age is here. It's exciting, and it's also profoundly anxiety-inducing. Let's start with how you define the second machine age. What are its qualities?
Well, we used the phrase second machine age as a direct reference to the first machine age, the Industrial Revolution that you mentioned. The difference is that while the Industrial Revolution automated and augmented a lot of our muscle power, the second machine age is doing the same thing for our brains, our mental and cognitive tasks. And that has some similarities. Both of them are leading to an inflection point in economic growth. But there's also some differences in terms of how it plays out for labor and income distribution.
Inflection point.
Yes.
That's one way to put it.
It's kind of a takeoff. I hope it's not too nerdy sounding. But if you look at human history, which we do in the book, you know, there have been wars and religions and philosophies and all sorts of things, but most of them didn't really bend the curve of human history until the Industrial Revolution and the steam engine and the other technologies that came along really started to take off in living standards and human progress. We see the same thing happening with the second machine age.
So a bend in the historical arc, and we're trying to figure out what direction it's going. You argue that technology is racing ahead, but our skills, our organizations, our economic policies are lagging a bit behind, that our technologies may be brilliant, but our ability to cope and integrate these technologies in our political structures and lives is in flux. So where do we start?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, that's explain some of the paradoxes we see. You know, we're at record wealth, $77 trillion, record productivity, GDP, profits, all sorts of good news that say that the pie is getting a lot bigger, largely because of technological progress. But there's a lot of people who are being left behind. In fact, the median worker, the person at the 50th percentile, is poorer now than he or she was in the 1990s. And the share of the population that's working is falling as well. The way to resolve that paradox of the amazing good news and also that troubling news is that in many ways our skills, our organizations, our institutions aren't keeping up with the technology. So a lot of people are falling behind.
And specifically, let's talk about that. Are we talking about education? Are we talking about science and engineering, STEM education? Are we talking about people who previously worked in industrial factories? What is it that fundamentally needs to be addressed to get at some of these inequities?
Well, I'm not too worried about the STEM workers and the technologists. Many of them are doing great, and that's wonderful news. The issue is that there are a lot of tasks that used to be done by humans that can now be done by machines. One huge category is what we call routine information processing, which is what a lot of Americans do in their everyday jobs. Things like tax preparers or travel agents, you know, handling knowledge work and information work. That kind of job is more and more amenable to automation. The number of tax preparers has fallen substantially because you can now take that process and codify it and digitize it and replicate it with TurboTax and software like that.
And this book celebrates disruption and entrepreneurship. But back to that challenge of integration, one thing I want to ask you about is, for example, Airbnb in New York City. Rules about what is or isn't a hotel have a purpose in this city, and regulation was involved but pretty straightforward. And now, enabled by digital technology, peer-to-peer sharing with rooms to rent, that's rubbing up against that. The celebration of the sharing economy is rubbing up against the old rules. And often that gets described by technologists along the spectrum as you're either future-oriented or you're a relic. So that creates a lot of tension in the public debate. How do you talk about that?
Well, I think you raised both parts of it. There's a lot of legitimate regulation for health and safety, but there's also too often regulators and incumbents use those rules to try to, in the words of Tim O'Reilly, protect the past from the future. And that's a losing strategy. You can't hold back the future. And here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the taxi commission tried to prevent Uber from operating. And in France, it was even worse. They put in for a while a mandatory 15-minute delay before an Uber car could arrive, just to try to keep the old taxis competitive. Those kind of regulations, they're really not about health or safety or customer service. They're just about trying to protect incumbents. And ultimately, the way we're going to get the most from these new technologies is by embracing new ways of working that use not just the technology, but innovative business models, new skills. And that's how it's always been. And that's how we need to understand that we're going to get the most out of the new technologies.
Let's talk about innovative business models. What does an innovative business model look like? Are the objectives to use digital technology to increase productivity? Or how do you talk about the ways to position, if you're a business owner, creating a business model that's going to sustain you into the 21st century? What are some of those characteristics?
Yeah, sure. The thing to recognize is that just using the technology with the same old business model rarely works. When electricity was introduced, it took literally 30 years before people figured out how to reconfigure factories so that they could really take advantage of it. And at first, productivity didn't increase until they made those changes. Today, there's a different set of changes that often involve, as you mentioned, the peer economy and more lateral sharing. Transaction costs are dramatically lower, so you can have micro multinationals that have global reach, but with just a few employees. You can digitize a lot of products that you couldn't digitize before and convert parts of them into algorithms that, the Moneyball approach where machines help make some of the decisions. There are a whole set of different kinds of business models that are emerging. And as entrepreneurs keep inventing new ones, we'll find that some of them work and others don't work. I don't think that there's a preset recipe of exactly how to use the technologies most effectively. What Andy and I like to say is that we need to crowdsource this problem and kind of let 1,000 flowers bloom. And we're going to see some unexpected models take off, and other ones that we thought were sure hits will fail.
It seems to me that while a lot of the knowledge work, as you say, can be automated, there's still that gap of creating, holding someone's hand along with it. Like, I think if I was a tax preparer, maybe I'm not doing the taxes, but I'm teaching people how to use TurboTax. I think I could get somebody to pay me to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's, in a way, that's good news, that machines tend to be best at the sort of rote routine parts of jobs. And people, it turns out, are better at the creative parts, the exception handling. They're also better at relationships and interacting with other people, whether that's motivating people or making them feel comfortable or caring and nurturing for people. So I can see a new division of labor going forward where people do kind of in many ways the more human parts of work and machines take over the more routine parts.
Who's advocating for the humans in this? Because one of the things that in the reviews of your book, the word that comes up over and over again is optimistic, that this is sort of a celebration of where we're going, enabled by digital technology in this second machine age. But who's looking out for the people who are hurt by when there's increasing productivity, increasing GDP, but wages aren't increasing?
Well, we all have to. You're doing it with your phone and with this interview over the phone. I'm doing it. And I think one of the reasons we wrote the book was to change the conversation and get people focused to understand that these optimistic visions that we lay out in the book don't happen automatically. They depend on us consciously advocating for it. So we do call ourselves optimists, but we qualify that. We call ourselves mindful optimists, that there's no technological utopia that's waiting for us inevitably, or for that matter, a dystopia that's going to, you know, put everybody out of work. The choice is ours. It's going to depend on how we reskill, how we change our public policies. Looking back at the first machine age, there were some gargantuan changes like universal public education and changes in tax policy and new kinds of organizations that we invented alongside those new technologies. Similarly, big changes are needed to embrace the benefits of the new technologies.
And one of the interesting things about the book is at some points your take on what's actually possible and what needs to be done by humans and what can be done by computers shifts, like with the case with self-driving cars. What increased your confidence in self-driving cars, that cars could handle it and they didn't need people at the wheel?
Well, it was striking. I mean, I try to be modest about my expectations of how well I understand technology, because I frankly keep being surprised. The self-driving cars is a perfect example. 10 years ago, I taught a class where we discussed, you know, what can machines do and what can't they do, kind of like our conversation right now. And I confidently explained that driving a car was something machines just can't do. There's too much unstructured information and data coming in. There's no set rules, especially in Boston, for how you should drive. Shortly thereafter, in the summer of 2012, I was riding in a self-driving car down Route 101, so I was proven wrong. And at first, as I sat in that car, I was kind of scared because, you don't quite know how it's going to handle it. The car in front of us on the highway came to a complete dead stop, and I was just kind of gripping the seat, hoping that my robot driver would recognize that. Fortunately, it did. I'm here to talk to you on the phone because it did come to a very smooth, comfortable stop. And I can say that by the end of the ride, you know, I was, frankly, Andy and I were kind of bored because it was driving so smoothly, so reliably, following all the rules, that an hour into it, we were just taking it for granted, you know, kind of like you might with, a dishwasher.
One of the concerns, however, is, of course, overshooting confidence in technology. Perhaps that one ride went smoothly, but whether it's always going to go smoothly. I mean, one of the examples in your book that rings true for me is, as a journalist, you talk about how Forbes is experimenting with a program where a computer writes its corporate earnings previews on its website. What's the potential of things being missed when you take it out of a human mind and put it in the hands of a computer?
Oh, for sure. There are going to be mistakes, and there have been mistakes as well as successes. So it's not a smooth path going forward. We were surprised to see that machines can't just, you know, read and grade essays, but now they're beginning to write them. You know, simple ones, sort of like an earnings report or a sports story. But that's a category that, again, we didn't think was going to happen. There are so many of these that we talk about in the book that have kicked in just in the past 5 years or so, as big data allows us to crack a lot of problems that previously people said were insoluble. I mean, we have a lot of kind of fun quotes in there about people predicting that something couldn't be done, and then lo and behold, machine intelligence, machine learning, and other technologies have led to breakthroughs recently. So we are at this inflection point where things are beginning to take off.
You write about how Moore's Law, a kind of exponentially doubling of computing power that happens every year, how that's fueling much of the rapid progress in technology and limiting our ability to predict what, you know, our economy is going to look like in 5, 10, or 50 years. So how do we even prepare and try to integrate our economic and personal lives into this second machine age when the pace of change is so rapid?
Yeah, Moore's Law and the exponential changes is one of the fundamental drivers. We talk about two others, which are the digitization and application of data and combinatorial innovation. And when you put the three of those together, it is a whole game changer in how technology advances. It makes it kind of difficult to predict how we're going to react. And in the book, we find it easier to say where the technology is going and a lot harder to make predictions about how we all will respond to it. And that's why we do call ourselves mindful optimists, because we think that our responses are very flexible, that we have the freedom to choose different kinds of paths, and some of them are much more optimistic than others.
So it's just to bring that mindful optimism home, say you're talking to parents out there who are trying to figure out how to prepare their children to compete in this rapidly changing economic landscape. What are the qualities that kids will be best positioned if when they come out into this economy that we don't really know what its textures are going to be? What would you say are the things that parents should really make sure are getting emphasized in their kids' education?
Well, that's a great question and a very important one. Let me give three kinds of advice. The first is to learn to do things that machines are not good at. And we talked about some of those, creativity and discovery, doing something really different. Machines are great at routine processing, but not at making those leaps. And related to that is, some of the arts and other creative areas. A second kind of thing that machines can't do well is interpersonal relationships. EQ, emotional intelligence, not just IQ, is increasingly important. So motivating people, nurturing people, caring for people, and there are a lot of jobs where those are really important. The second broad category of advice that I would give is that you need to be prepared to do lifelong learning. That set of skills that we talk about more in the book that are important today, they're evolving as well. Never say never in terms of what you think a machine can or cannot do. So we all have to be prepared to not just go to school for 12
scary.
Or 16 years, just constantly learning and being ready to adapt your career and your skills. And then the third piece of advice I would say is to really think about what you're passionate about and focus on that. I mean, that's always been good advice. But going forward, we're going to have a lot more winner-take-all markets where the person who's really best in the world at something, it could even be something very narrow and focused, they're going to have an audience of millions or even billions. And the people who are sort of average or above average are going to have a very hard time succeeding. And so there's even more of a premium than there was in the past on doing something you're passionate about and doing it well.
Eric Brynjolfsson is the co-author, along with Andrew McAfee, of The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies, a Time for Passion, and a Time for Winner-Take-All Markets. Thanks so much for joining us, Eric.
Real pleasure talking to you, Anna.
Coming up, we're going to have a conversation about the need to update those stock images of working women that show up across our media landscape. Give us a call and let us know what images of women just make you roll your eyes. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer.